let's just have a quick recap of yesterday's lecture. Well, I'm not going to recap the whole lecture. I just wanted to remind you of something. So we saw yesterday that quantum theory can be divided into two distinct components. Where the first component is to do with identifying the energy level structure, of some system. So this is answering questions like, what's the appropriate Hilbert space? What's the appropriate state vector for a given preparation? What's the Hamiltonian that describes the interactions between the system, or just the evolution of the system? And what's an operator that can describe a measurement that we make? And then the second component is to do with predicting the statistics associated with an agent that's interacting with the system. Okay, and so both of these components are important, but we're not going to, in this course, we're not going to discuss how to get all of these things. We're just going to assume that these have been given to us, and then we can use those things to make predictions about experiments. And so we're going to focus a little bit more on the general structure of how we can describe different types of experiments using realistic, well, first we'll talk about the ideal postulates and then using the realistic postulates. Okay, and there's kind of, well, this is important to mention, but I'm not going to go into any level of detail about this, but there's a subtle, there are subtleties associated with continuous systems. So, some subtleties. So in particular, that the Hilbert space structure for continuous systems is not general enough to describe certain systems. So for example, well, so say Hilbert space, not general. So one example of these types of states that really shouldn't live in a Hilbert space are plane waves of a single particle. So you might think, well, hang on a second. In like undergrad, we always just deal with things like wave functions of particles, and you know, there's no problem. And so it turns out in practice, there actually is no problem. You can just pretend that everything is okay. But if you care about these sorts of things, you might want to motivate that it actually is okay. And so people have approached this in two different ways. In particular, the two approaches are by Dirac and by von Neumann. So, two approaches to to fix this. So the first is by Dirac. And so this approach is called the rigged Hilbert space. And so in this approach, what he does is he extends the Hilbert space to include a broader set of states. And then in the second approach, by von Neumann, so he just keeps the Hilbert space as it is, but then he introduces a generalized spectral decomposition. So I'm not going to say any more than this about that. It turns out that in practice, it doesn't matter if you're dealing with continuous systems. For our purposes, at least for my section of the course, we're always going to be dealing with discrete systems anyway. But if this is something that you're interested in, and it might be interested if you're trying to extend quantum theory beyond what it does now, then you might want to know more about it. So if you want to know more, I suggest the lectures by Joseph Emerson. And you can find these on Pearsa. There's two of them. And the numbers for that are as follows. Okay. And you don't have to write them down. They're in the notes as well. Okay. So I just wanted to kind of tell you about that, but we won't worry about it for my course. Okay, so now what I'd like to do is present the ideal postulates. So we'll spend probably most of this lecture going through these. And I'll present the general postulates and give you a bunch of examples. And then at the end, I'll tell you about this procedure called quantum state tomography. But okay, let's start with the postulates. So the first postulate corresponds to preparations. So postulate one says that an ideal preparation is described by a Hilbert space vector called a pure state. And we represent it as this psi. So let's talk a little bit about some properties of Hilbert spaces. Okay, so there is, well, given a Hilbert space H, there's a dual space which we denote as H dagger. And this dual space consists of all continuous linear functionals mapping elements of the Hilbert space to complex scalars. Okay, and the second property is a consequence of what's known as Riesz's representation theorem. Which says that in Dirac notation, so Dirac notation is this business of writing down bras and kets, like that state psi. So in Dirac notation, we can just write down the dual to this ket like that. So this refers to a unique element of the dual space. So this turns out to make calculations in quantum mechanics really simple. Okay, so also a few things I want to note about the states. Okay, so all vectors that differ by scalar multiplication with an arbitrary phase. So for example, if I have the state psi and I multiply it by a phase like this, these are physically indistinguishable from the state psi. So maybe you don't like that. I kind of don't like it. I don't know what, I think it's strange to have two different representations of the same physical state, or the same preparation. So yeah, if you don't like it, you might prefer representing states as projectors. And in that case, you can represent your state as a density operator, which in this case is a projector, and then you find that when you take the conjugate transpose of this operator, you get an e to the minus phi, and then these phases cancel. And so these things are just exactly the same projector. And so maybe some food for thought. Perhaps there's something deep about this. Perhaps this state vector representation of quantum mechanics is not really the right representation. Maybe we should be thinking about things in terms of density operators to get rid of this this strange phase, this strange global phase. That's just kind of a stray thought. So it's up to you whether you want to take that seriously or not. But yeah, to me, it seems kind of more natural to think in terms of density operators than these state vectors. Okay, but mathematically, it's, well, not mathematically, just logistically, it's easier to do everything with state vectors because you don't want to be carrying around, you know, two copies of the same thing and expanding out these large density operators. So we'll stick with just dealing with these. Okay, so in quantum theory, any pure state can be expressed as a discrete linear combination of orthonormal elements. So let's see. Can express any pure state like so. Where the phi j's form an orthonormal basis. Of the Hilbert space H satisfying this condition that the inner product is one when these are the same and it's zero when I and J differ. Okay, and the condition when these are the same, so this it's often known as the normalization condition. Okay, so given this decomposition that I gave, can you guys tell me what the condition is on the coefficient Cj for this ket to be normalized?
Sum of the norm squares equals 1.
Yeah, so the sum of the norm squared of the coefficients is equal to 1. Okay, so that's the general case, but maybe let's try and get some physical pictures in our head. So I want to write down a few examples of pure states representing different preparations of physical systems. So maybe we'll do that here. And maybe as we do this, you guys can think of a few of your own examples that we can add. So kind of the most obvious one that I can think of is a two-level atom. So for example, I could write psi is equal to an equal superposition of the state being in the ground state or the excited state. What's another two-level system we saw yesterday that I talked about? My favorite two-level system. Yeah, photon polarization. Actually, I'll call this R. So this has got an I in front of it, so it gives us a right circularly polarized light. Another one you might think of is photon number superposition. So Mita will later talk about second quantized notation, but in this notation, we talk about numbers of particles. So if these particles are photons, I can make superpositions of these. So, for example, I could have something that is a superposition of the vacuum state and maybe a single photon state and a two photon state. So that's one physical system you can have. And here you notice that already we're starting to double, to make multiple use of the same notation. So often I write zeros and ones to represent logical qubits of two-level atoms, two-level systems. But now here I'm reusing the same notation to represent the number of photons. So sometimes this happens, and you just need to know from the context what's going on. Another example of a photon number superposition is what's known as a coherent state. So this is a really common state that you see in quantum optics. And it's typically represented by this complex parameter alpha. And it looks like this. So here now we have a superposition of photon number states, but they go all the way from 0 to infinity. And the reason this state is really popular in quantum optics is that it's a very good model for the state of a laser. So if you have a single frequency laser, like some sort of red laser pointer, and it has all of the coherence properties of a laser, then you can use this state to make predictions about experiments that you would have when you interact the laser with a quantum mechanical system. Okay, another example. Maybe a spin one particle. So let's say it's a superposition of being in the plus spin, zero and minus one. Okay, and so far I've been dealing with kind of microscopic systems, but we can also write down quantum states for macroscopic systems. So for example, if I had a cat, which is a macroscopic system, this cat could be dead or it could be alive. So I can do things like write down the quantum state of a cat is an equal superposition of an alive cat plus a dead cat, and so on. And so often you see people writing down things like this, maybe even doing things like, you know, superposition of you getting this outcome of a measurement and you getting a different outcome of a measurement, or maybe the universe in the superposition of this state and that state. So these things come up in foundations when people try to kind of make conclusions that are counterintuitive. But of course, physically, it's going to be really difficult to prepare a state that's in the superposition of a cat being alive or dead. But anyway, so these are some examples. Can you guys think of any other like things, obvious things that I missed that maybe we can write as well in this form? No, I've probably covered most of the things. Okay, so now we can move on to transformations. And maybe let me just redraw my boxes. Okay, so yeah, the scenario that we're considering is that we have some sort of preparation that we can tune the knob on here to specify what preparation we have. We have a push button that says go. Then something happens and we can apply some kind of transformation, which we can also select on our device. And then we can make a measurement where we have the option to pick what kind of measurement we're making, and then we get an output of that measurement. Okay, so between the time that the state gets prepared and measured, we can apply some kind of transformations, and these are described by postulate 2. So postulate 2, ideal transformations. Are generated by a linear operator U as follows. Where this operator satisfies this equation. Where H is a self-adjoint operator representing the system energy function and T is time. And all of this is subject to the initial condition that u as a function of t1, u at t1, t1 is equal to the identity. So that's a long one. None of the others are going to be this long. So we've got things described in, yes?
I have a big problem with this postulate.
Okay.
Why, I don't see no a priori reason why the observable should be self-adjoint.
Because you want the spectral theory.
inspector of Durham can only be through self-adjoined operators. And if you want, being self-adjoined is equivalent to having your eigen values, well, your spectra to be real.
Yes, I know that argument, and I hate the argument.
Why?
Because you can still have operator that what one would call the normal operator that can be with itself adjoined. You can still have complex.
No,
I can make
machines that yield banana and apple as answers, but banana and apple are equivalent to one and zero, right? I mean, I get that I don't want my experiments to yield a real number, but what they yield should be as structurable as real numbers. I mean, that seems
reasonable. If a complex number is a two-dimensional real number system, so what's the problem with that?
It has to do with the way that it's acting on the dual. Like, it's not just that you want a real spectra, you also want it to act on the dual. Like, it's acting. Does that make sense? Am I making sense? Like, it needs to be Hermitian because you want a measurement like in this place of your transformation. How do you?
Keep going.
Am I making any sense? Or maybe not.
If you have two real numbers, then you have compatibility, right? When you have the problem of whether two observables are accepting that observables are self-adjoined operators, you always have the problem whether they are commensurable, right? It's a big problem in quantum mechanics.
But
sure.
Commensurability is just bracket relation between those two. But you can have bracket relation even if the operator is not self-adjoined. What's the problem?
No, I'm saying that I get what you're saying. Like, if I take complex linear combinations of self-adjoined operators, I get a non-self-adjoined operator, which whose values are just simply complex the elements of R2,
yeah.
Right? But then I have to make sure that the real and the imaginary part are commensurable, right?
And you can make that commensurable if your operator is normal.
Okay. So now, no. This is like a super, super awesome discussion, and I feel so sad that I have to cut it off. But I've written the question down so we can all remember it and think about it. And I think it would be great if we continued this discussion in the tutorial. But so I do want to start making a list of things that come up that maybe I don't immediately know the answer to. So it's here. We'll remember it and we'll discuss.
So you do have non-Hermitian.
Like,
there is a whole area
that is studied. Yeah, but then those ultimately represent open systems.
Yeah.
So there's some sort of implicit interaction with some.
Yeah. But that's
so
because,
yeah.
You know, you have complex energies between.
But in this case, we're talking about closed idealized systems. So maybe that doesn't apply. But I think that's a really good point. Yeah. Okay. Great questions, guys. And great discussion, which you should stop. Are you signaling that you want to continue the discussion via chat? No.
Get out.
No. Yeah, sometimes when I sit at the back, I see you guys like chatting to each other, and I'm like,
no.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, where was I? Totally lost my train of thought. Okay, yeah, so some comments. So I've referenced this Hamiltonian H. Well, I haven't even said it's a Hamiltonian, but that's what it is. So the form of H is not part of the postulate because that's something that belongs to this first component of quantum theory, and where the postulates are only describing the second component. So we don't have that in the postulates, and in practice it needs to be determined empirically, like from, for example, the Lagrangian of the system. Okay, some other comments. So the differential equation, maybe I'll call it 1, implies that U is unitary. And so that's something you guys are going to show in the tutorial this afternoon. And for bounded operators. Then self-adjoint and Hermitian are the same thing. But for infinite dimensional systems, Hilbert spaces, there's a subtle difference between these. So if you want to know more about that, I suggest this reference. So it's by Francois, I can't pronounce this, Jerry, and it's on the archive. And I know you guys can't really see what I'm writing here, and I don't have space to put this up, but this link is going to be on the, in the notes. And maybe I'll move it up for the sake of the people watching online.
Equation implies that you is unitary.
Yeah, so you guys are going to show that in a tutorial.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, you can like just go through the steps and show it. So we'll do that this afternoon. Yeah. Yeah.
So for bounded operators, self and joint and Hermitian are the same.
Yes.
I mean, it's the same for continuous systems, just as long as it's not infinite Hilbert space?
Good question. I don't know. I would say.
It's the same as
yes,
long as the outcomes of the measurement are bounded. Like you can, for example, the position is not bounded because a particle can be infinite far away or not. That their Hermitian is and self-adjointness are different. But if you have something, for example, a different observable would be the observable, I measure my particle to be within this room. That's bounded observable because it has only two outcomes. Either I do or I don't. That's
awesome, thank you. Okay, so a few examples.
Means infinite, has the same meaning of infinite, but for finite dimensions.
Yes.
Why?
No. Not
oh.
The Hilbert space itself, it's just, no, it's not the same thing.
Yeah, it's not the same.
Not the same thing.
Okay.
It means that the outcomes are within a bounded
yeah.
setting the real numbers.
But that implies that the Hilbert space is finite.
No.
I think that only the finite dimensions means that a drawing is the same as a Hermitian.
I'm adding this.
Just
physicists
and
math,
should
have different terminology.
No, in self, so Hermitian is symmetry for mathematicians.
Okay.
Self-adjoint. What is true is that in finite dimensions, every operator is bounded. Not the other way around.
Okay, I've put it up there for us to clarify later. Okay, so I just wanted to give a few examples of unitary transformations on the Bloch sphere for a 2D system. Okay, so recall that we can write down an arbitrary pure state. Like this. and that we can represent this on the Bloch sphere. That. And so unitary operations for a two-dimensional Hilbert space, like I said yesterday, are nothing but rotations in the Bloch sphere, and we can write these in terms of Pauli operators. So unitaries are just rotations. So for example, if I have a rotation about the x-axis by an angle theta. Oh, okay, I've got like too many thetas. Okay, let's call this chi. So it's given in terms of the Pauli X matrix. The rotation about the Y axis is given in terms of the Pauli Y. And the rotation about the Z axis is given in terms of the Pauli Z. Okay, and let's just define the Pauli operators in the 0-1 basis. So sigma z is the easy one. It's just, oh, can I? Okay, it's much easier if I do that. Does everyone understand when I do that? You're not gonna get confused that thinking that's an x? Okay, no, because I one lecture a few years ago, I was just writing this all the time, and after, at the end, someone's like, so, but what is this x you keep drawing? So this just means ket bra. Okay. So, and then the sigma x has the same form, but in terms of the other eigenstates, where plus or minus is plus or minus 1, 1, 2, and sigma y is the same, but with the other. Eigenstates, where the definition of this is the same, but there's an I in there. So we can also just write these. This is the y axis, z, and x. Okay. Okay, so that's if you just want to rotate about the x, y, or z axes, but you can do a more general rotation about an arbitrary axis. So you can say a rotation about the axis given by the vector m by angle theta is e to the minus I theta on 2, and then the dot product between this vector and a vector of the Pauli matrices. So where n is a unit vector, and this is a vector of the Pauli matrices. Okay, so now I'm gonna ask you guys to do some rotations for me, just to see whether, yeah, whether this makes sense. Okay, so let's say if I start with, the initial state plus. And I apply the rotation y pi onto. Then where's the final state going to be? So I'm hoping that you're not doing the calculation and you're just like using the visual representation, because the reason I'm giving you these visual tools is so that you can very quickly answer these questions. And in fact, so the quizzes we're going to have this afternoon, if you use the tricks, they're really fast. But if you're going to be sitting down and explicitly doing the calculations, then they might take you quite a while. So I'm hoping that what you did is you looked at the sphere and identified that this is a rotation by the y about the y-axis, which is this axis, by an angle pi on 2, which will rotate you down to here. And then you have the one state. And actually, I'm like 90% sure that the rotation is in that direction. Maybe it's in the other one, so we can do the explicit calculation to check. But I'm going to go with it rotates in this direction. You know what? Maybe it's the other direction, actually, because the positive axis is here. But anyway, that's something for us to check later. Okay, so what about a different initial state? Let's say we start with this state that I have here, the zero state. And I apply the rotation Rz by angle pi on 3. That's our initial state up here. So don't do the calculation, just use the sphere. Correct, it doesn't change. So because our state is like this, and then we're rotating about this axis, so it's going to apply a global phase, but that phase is not going to have any measurable consequences. And if we wrote it as a density operator, it wouldn't change at all. Okay, cool. So now I just like to move on to measurements. The things we've talked about so far, the states and the unitaries, a lot of that may be quite familiar to you from your undergraduate quantum mechanics, but I think this discussion of measurement is going to be a little bit more expanded from the typical measurements you see in undergrad, which are just in terms of expectation values. Okay, so postulate three. An ideal measurement is represented by a collection of collection, so this set PM of projection operators. The index M refers to the measurement outcomes I'm not going to write it all out, but the measurement outcomes that may occur in the experiment and the probability of finding outcome M given preparation psi is probability equals to the projected PM sandwiched between the state psi. Okay, and this last part of the postulate is known as the Born rule. And so what this does is it predicts the relative frequency of each outcome M obtained from an ensemble of measurements on single copies of the system. So what I mean by that is not that I take a given system and then measure it multiple times over and over again. I have to prepare the same preparation multiple times, and then every time I make a preparation, I then do a measurement. Then I repeat the same preparation and do a measurement, repeat the same preparation and do a measurement. And so over time, what I will get is a histogram that might look something like this. Where M could be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and so on. Okay, and so this is a more detailed description of a measurement than simply taking the expectation value. So the expectation value would be just the average of all of these outcomes. So maybe the expectation value of an operator A might lie somewhere here, but here we have a full distribution. Okay, so what's the relationship between this operator A and these projectors M? Well, they're related by the spectral decomposition of this operator. Let's put hats in it. So A can be decomposed into a sum over the projectors L with some coefficients out the front. Okay, and so we can, let me just check. Right, so we can define, wait, which way are we deriving it? Okay, so given this definition and the Born rule, we can derive the familiar expression for the expectation value of some operator. So let's do that. So we know just from probability theory that the expectation value is going to be a sum over the outcomes weighted by the probability of that outcome. And so then we can put in our expression for the Born rule in here. And then using the spectral decomposition, we can write this as that. And that's typically what you may have seen in undergrad as how we compute the expectation value of some particular operator. Okay, so the postulate gives us the statistics that will be associated with a measurement, but we can also compute the state corresponding, we can write down this post-measurement state given a particular outcome. So, so after measurement, given an outcome M, the state is so we give it a little subscript M to correspond to the outcome M, and then we act the projector corresponding to outcome M on the initial state, and then we divide by the probability, or square root of the probability. And I also wanted to note, maybe I should have said this earlier, that the projection operators satisfy the following. Okay, so maybe you might be thinking, why don't we include this this part in the actual measurement postulate? Why are we only including the component dealing with the statistics in the postulate? Can you maybe think why? Like, because actually some people do include this as part of the measurement postulate, but can you maybe think of a reason why you might want to keep it separate? Okay, so I wrote down the measurement postulate, and inside the box, I just gave you Born's rule for predicting the probabilities of the outcome. And then I gave you some more information saying that after the measurement, I can write down the post-measurement state like this. So why did I not include this as part of the measurement postulate? Yeah?
Maybe it's to be consistent with the fact that if we should do again the measure, we should type F is equal to 1. Yeah, it's another part of saying, okay, we want to have always the same result of the measure once we have made points.
Yeah, so I think what you're talking about is this property of projectors, that once you make a particular measurement, then if you repeat that same measurement, you'll always get the same outcome. I don't know if that's necessarily related to this choice of keeping it out of the postulate, but maybe it is. But I think, yeah, it's sort of to do with, it is to do with the fact that you can measure it again. That is, yeah, related in some way. Yeah. Yep.
So the top one has more to do with like an entire ensemble or creating statistics for a given state prepared multiple times in subjective to projective measurements.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the second one describes one particular instance of measurement.
That's true as well. Yeah, I think that's related. Yep. Yeah.
Sorry.
No, go ahead. I'm curious.
Maybe it has to do with the fact that the second one is a quantum operation that's happened. Like the box, the one is the what you read from the box, and the other is the output of the box, right?
Yes.
And it's the CPPT.
Well, okay, so it's not a CPTP map. Actually, it's not. I don't think I don't think it's trace preserving. It is a map, but I don't think it's trace preserving. Yeah. Yeah. Did you? Yeah.
I think it goes way back to the idea that, like, you don't want to put it that within the postulate because you don't know a quantum state until you make a measurement.
Yeah.
Like you don't know. It's just like you can't put it that in a postulate.
Well, sort of. We put it into postulate one, though. We said that a preparation is given by. Yeah, I mean, I think you're all kind of like on the right track, and this isn't okay. So with like quantum theory, it's not like different people have different takes on it, and like you'll find there must be like 20 different sets of postulates that people have, and they use different ones to serve different purposes, and so here. Well, one reason that I wouldn't put it in there is that you can think of this as a form of state preparation, because I can use a measurement to prepare this state, and so it's kind of not clear whether I should put it into the first postulate or the third postulate. That would be one main reason. Yeah, and actually no. Yeah, I was going to say a second thing, but I think I'm just going to stick with that. I can think of it as a form of state preparation. And so I don't know which postulate to put into. But yes, do you want to say? Oh, sorry, you.
You didn't ask the projectors to be you're talking about. Instead, how you want it to be?
I think they are orthogonal. Yeah.
But
I didn't put it in the postulate. It should. Okay. No, that's implicit in the fact that I've called it a projector. So I think if it's. Is that true? I think projectors have to be orthogonal.
I mean,
but,
it's a matter of how you...
Okay,
how you
I'm defining projectors to be orthogonal. But the fact that you're scrunching up your face means that maybe I shouldn't be doing that. So we can come back to it. Let's put it as a thing to look at later. Okay, yeah. So the projectors should be orthogonal, but whether we should put that definition into the postulate or whether it's implicit, we can check that later. Okay, so maybe just another quick quiz for the class. I'm going to give you some things, and you can tell me whether they are projectors or not. Is that a projector?
I'm an operator.
Well, no. Okay, what about this? Where plus is defined the way I defined it?
Yes.
Yes. These are too easy for you. Okay, what about Everyone's nodding, but I right, exactly, yeah. So it's, if I had the normalizations here, then it would be a projector, but without the normalizations, it, when I square it, it has the same form, but it won't have the right coefficient out the front. So it won't satisfy this. Okay, what about this one? No. And this is the last one.
Yes. Oh, it depends where.
Hmm?
It depends where.
In situ?
What? Does it matter? Does it matter?
No, yeah. Yeah, because you're 1 hour talking about, yeah.
Yeah, okay, yeah, sorry, okay. Yes, 0 and 1 are orthogonal. Yep. Yeah, if I don't specify that, usually I take the logical qubits to be orthogonal. So yes, this is a projector, but it's a rank 2 projector. So these are going to show up later when we talk about coarse-grained measurements. So sometimes you can have a measurement that doesn't give you complete information. So for example, if I was making a measurement of this photon number state here, I could have a detector that tells me either I had no photons or some photons, but it doesn't tell me how many. So then I would have one projector corresponding to this outcome, and then another rank 2 projector, which is the sum of these two, which won't distinguish between the number of photons. And so there'll be a question on that on the quiz. Okay, so I think that's, oh yeah, okay. So one more thing I kind of wanted to say about language. I don't know, maybe I think I'm just gonna like mess it up and confuse you more rather than clarify things. But, okay. So sometimes sometimes people say, okay, they say I measure, okay, yeah, this is what people have said in the past. So I make a measurement PM, meaning that they got outcome PM. So we shouldn't use that language. When you make a measurement, you have to specify the full set of projectors. So that's, so because you're saying I make, which means that you have to have control over what you're doing. So you can control the set of projectors that you use in your experiment. You can't control what the outcome is. The outcome happens randomly. So when you get outcome M corresponding to projector PM, that's not something you do. So you don't make the measurement M. You get outcome M. The universe gives you this outcome, but you don't do it. So just don't say I make the measurement M. Maybe that's the best way to summarize it. Because PM is an outcome of the measurement. Okay, so the final thing I wanted to talk about, I guess we can do quantum state tomography quickly. So before quantum state tomography, I wanted to just talk about changing the measurement basis, which we talked about yesterday when I was drawing the circuit diagrams, but let's just recap that quickly. Okay, so changing the measurement bases. Okay, so yeah, as I said yesterday, sometimes when you're dealing with a physical system, there's a preferred basis in which you can make a measurement. So when it comes to the photon, the polarized photon, the preferred basis is the horizontal and vertical polarization, because we have beam splitters that can split into those polarizations. If you're dealing with a two-level atom, then the preferred basis is typically the ground and excited basis of the atom. Some other systems might have maybe a spin half particle has a preferred basis, which is based on the Stern-Gerlach device that you built in your lab. Maybe it's really hard to rotate the thing. So for various reasons, you might have to measure in a particular basis, but your experiment requires you to actually measure in a different basis. And so the way that you do that is by changing the basis using unitary operations. So for example, say I want to measure in this basis. So I'll denote it as projectors onto the plus and minus states of the Bloch sphere. So projecting onto these guys. Oh, and another alternate way to say that is I could say I want to measure in the sigma x spaces. That's the same thing. So when you say I want to measure in a basis corresponding to an observable, that just means you write down the set of projectors that are given in the spectral decomposition of that observable. Okay, but say I want to measure in this basis, but I only have a device that can measure in the 0, 1 basis. Okay, if I wanted to specify this basis in terms of saying like the observable, what language would I use? Yeah, so I would say or in the sigma z basis. Okay. Okay, so as I said yesterday, so we can do this by applying a unitary operation. So I have my initial state psi. I apply some unitary operation, and then I perform my measurement in the 0, 1 basis. So what are the probabilities that are going to be associated with this? Well, so let's just define this thing as the box psi prime which is then measured in the the 0, 1 basis. So the probability for that, for getting outcome M, is going to be just the Born rule. So psi prime for the projector M, where M is 0, 1. Actually, sorry, let me change notation. Let's just call this the set PM. Okay, but we know that psi is just the unitary operator acting on, sorry, psi prime is just the unitary operator acting on psi. So we get psi u dagger PM U psi. And now I can just define a new projection operator like that. So I'll call it P prime, where like that. So another way to think about this is that I can just rewrite this whole box as a measurement in the P prime basis. Okay, and so you can kind of, like, you can see it on the block sphere, you can see it in two different ways. Like, one way you can think about as you're measuring in this basis, but you're rotating the state. Or you can keep the state where it is and rotate the basis, and it just gives you the same projections onto the basis in which you're measuring. Okay, so maybe just to write this explicitly. So now we have everything that we need to talk about quantum state tomography. And quantum state tomography is a procedure that lets you answer the question, you know, if you tell me I have a preparation that has the density operator psi, how do I actually know that? Like, or sorry, the density operator rho, how do I actually know that? And so the way that you know that is by characterizing your preparation procedure. And to do that, you have to make a lot of different measurements. And so, like I was saying before, when we're building up statistics, we can't just take the same state, the same physical system, and then make a preparation and then measure that many times. I have to always follow the procedure where I first do the preparation, then I make a measurement and get one outcome. That's one blip on my histogram. Then I repeat. I make the preparation, measure again, get another outcome. And by doing this, I can build up statistics. But in order to completely characterize the state, I can't just do that for one set of measurements. I need to measure in an orthonormal, in an informationally complete basis. So for the block sphere, what that would correspond to is measuring in the sigma z, sigma x, and sigma y bases. And that will give you the projections onto the x, y, and z axes. But for larger dimensional systems, you need to make more measurements. So, how can we see that this works? So it's kind of easier to do this if we think about the Pauli matrices in represented as matrices. So imagine I have my two systems. Well, we can call them spin up. They're given by vectors like this. And spin down is a vector like that. And then I have my identity and Pauli matrices that look like this. So I've labeled them differently, but these are just the X, Y, and Z Pauli matrices. And so it turns out that I can decompose an arbitrary density matrix as follows. So a sum from j equals 0 to 3 over some coefficients multiplied by the Pauli matrices. And then in matrix form, we can see that it looks like this. And how do we get the coefficients? Well, they are given by the trace of the density operator and the Pauli matrices. Which for a pure state, so if the density operator is this projector, then we can write this as and that's just given, well, that's just another way of writing down the expectation value for this Pauli matrix, sigma j. And so in the tutorial, you're going to actually go through and prove that this is the case. But you can kind of see that it makes sense because, well, we can check that A0 is going to be 1. And so you can see that this satisfies some of the properties of density matrices that we'll be talking about later, but maybe you've heard about. So if I take the trace of this, so I add these things together, then the A3s cancel. A0 plus A0 will give me 2 divided by 2 is 1. So I have a unit trace matrix.
Shouldn't the top right one be A1 minus IA2 and the bottom left A1 plus IA2?
Maybe. It's possible. Okay. But let's check it.
Because the sigma 2 has a minus I.
Yeah, I'm really bad at writing down the Pauli matrices correctly. So I probably just wrote it down the wrong way, but when I'm standing here, I can't check these things in my head. I know my brain somehow doesn't work. But if you guys can see it and you're checking it, then that's good. I can check it after class and then go, oh, okay. Okay. Fortunately, I'm not building planes that are carrying people across because these things matter in that case. But yeah, maybe not so much. But you should definitely call me out on it. Okay, but yeah, so you can see that the trace is 1 and you can see that it's Hermitian. So that's kind of what we would expect. So the final thing is I'm going to give you some statistics from a hypothetical quantum state tomography experiment, and then you can tell me what the density operator is corresponding to that state. Hopefully you will use some tricks rather than doing the calculations directly. And so the tricks are to figure out what the projections onto the axes of the Bloch sphere are, and then that'll tell you where the point is on the Bloch sphere, and then from that you should be able to tell me what the state is. So here is an example. So I've gone in and I've gone through the preparation procedure 3,000 times, let's say. And so 1,000 times I measure in the sigma x basis, 1,000 times in the sigma y basis, and 1,000 times in the sigma whatever, the third basis. And I get the following statistics. So on the y-axis, I have counts. so how many times I got this outcome. And on the x-axis, I have just the eigenstates. So plus one, minus one, plus one, minus one, plus one, minus one. And I make some histograms. And so here I find that I got 500 counts of each. When I measured in the sigma x basis, I got 500 counts each. Then I measured in the sigma y basis, and I got 1,000 counts for the plus one eigenstate and 0 counts for the minus one eigenstate. So given these statistics, what row would I use to describe the preparation procedure? And when you answer it, I'll like you to work me through the working rather than just, yeah, call out an answer. Sorry, talk me through the reasoning.
And I'm getting basically random for x and y, and I'm getting a value for z. So that's just consistent. I want you.
The one? Yeah. Mm. No, I think it's close.
Okay.
I think that's good reasoning, yeah. So okay, here I gave you an easy one. So the fact that it's equally distributed kind of
but
makes it
maybe
easy.
Maybe have the labels the other way around.
Yeah. So okay, so how would I do it? Well, the first thing I would do is I would figure out what the probabilities are. So I know they have to sum to one, so I would normalize them. Okay. And then I would just calculate the expectation values. So sigma x, we know is going to be, well, you can figure this out, but it's going to be the probability of getting outcome plus one minus the outcome minus one. And so that's going to be the case for all of them, actually. But let's just label this as x. So here we have a half minus a half. So that gives me zero. Sigma y will be the probability of getting plus one minus probability of getting minus one. Again, a half minus a half equals zero. And then sigma z is now going to be 1 minus 0, which is 1. Yes?
I don't really need to do that if I notice that. Oh, I got lucky because I got the axis of the measurement where that is 1.
No, that's true. So, yeah, if you like know, yep. So, what Julia pointed out is that in this case, I got lucky, and I know that with probability one, I always get this outcome. So I don't really have to compute the expectation values for the other ones, because this just tells me what the state is. In practice, you won't get so lucky. You probably chose the wrong basis and you'll have something different. So in that case, you'll have to go through and calculate each of the three expectation values. But let's assume that we weren't so clever and we just went through the whole procedure. So here we have the projection onto the sigma, onto the x-axis is zero. So along here, it'll be zero. The projection onto the y-axis is also zero. So that tells us that it has to lie somewhere in this, in the z-axis. And then what's the projection onto the z-axis? Well, it's one. So that tells us that rho is actually zero, zero. Yes, yes.
Okay. There's something that I don't think I ever completely understood, which is, so you mentioned that, okay, we will not usually get lucky when we have sort of errors in the measurement,
yeah,
and we're going to choose the right basis. How can I distinguish between those two different bases?
Between whether you got lucky or not?
Between whether I chose the wrong basis or I'm just having errors in my measurement.
Oh, that's like, that's like a huge like field of research that is like not solved. It's like how to like properly characterize errors inside inside your system is like it's hard. And I mean, sometimes you get stupid answers like that your state lies somewhere out here. And then you're like, well, that's not a physical state. How do I map that to a physical state? Like the most obvious thing that people were, well, the most naive thing that people were doing is just do that. But that's maybe not the best thing to do. So yeah, there's like a whole heap of research going on for how to actually like infer what the correct state is given a measurement. And so maybe you got something that's here and you don't know whether like that corresponds to a pure state.
Yeah,
and your measurement procedure is bad, or whether like that's your actual state. And so, okay, so that kind of brings me to the last point. So here we were talking about characterizing the preparation procedure by measuring in a bunch of different bases, which means that you know what your measurement device is and you know what your transformations are. But sometimes you don't know that. Sometimes you want to characterize your transformation device. And so then you need to send in a whole bunch of different preparations and make a whole bunch of different measurements. As long as they form an incomplete set, you should be able to, sorry, an informationally complete set, you should be able to characterize this. And then also you can characterize your measurement device if you know what these devices are. So the cool thing is that you don't need to know, like you don't need to know each one of these things perfectly. As long as you know something about each one of them and you distribute the unknown information across these different devices, then it turns out that you can still characterize each of these things kind of simultaneously. And that's a new area of research that people are doing. There's different names for it. Self-calibrating tomography is a name that we've used, but other people have used different names as well. So sometimes maybe, you know, you have one unknown parameter here and two unknown parameters there. And so then you can still like figure things out. So, but this is something that people are thinking about in experiments. How do we properly characterize things? Okay, so that's all I wanted to say.